Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today, I'll be taking time to speak with Concord Coalition Policy Director Josh Gordon and Executive Director Bob Bixby. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. Work on a disaster aid package halted as negotiations broke down, risking and delaying delivery of billions of dollars to areas affected by natural disasters like hurricanes, tornadoes, and wildfires. Republicans and Democrats are exchanging jabs over the aid requests. The House passed a $14.2 billion aid package in January, and the Senate has yet to take it up. The House bill's language is likely to be replaced by an aid package written by Senate appropriators. Congressional investigators, meanwhile, issued a report this week showing that a substantial chunk of the $35 billion in community development block grant funds for 2017 disasters has yet to be spent. The Government Accountability Office said only a tiny fraction of the grant money allocated for hurricane damage had actually been drawn down from accounts. Federal spending on cybersecurity could get a bump in the upcoming fiscal year. The Trump administration is seeking a 4.7% increase to $17.4 billion in fiscal year 2020. Even still, federal spending on cyber threats pales in comparison to spending in the private sector. The White House has cited industry forecasts showing that U.S. private sector spending rose roughly 8.7% in fiscal year 2019 to $124 billion. Spending for security at schools across the nation is increasing as nearly $1 billion in federal grants starts to reach communities. A year ago, Congress provided for the grant money to be spent over 10 years to improve school safety after the deaths of 17 people in a mass shooting at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. Most of the initial money has been used for law enforcement response teams and mental health-related efforts. It has also gone to training programs on violence prevention, assessments on how to make schools safer, and boosting security and surveillance efforts at schools. House and Senate budget writers may approach fiscal year 2020 spending caps differently. Senate budget writers are beginning to work this week on a blueprint that would maintain the caps imposed by a 2011 deficit reduction law, which would require a cut of about 10% or $126 billion in discretionary spending compared to the current fiscal year. The Senate's plan would apparently reject the president's request to boost military funding through use of a war-related account exempt from such caps. It would allow for only about $643 billion in defense spending compared to the White House's proposal of $750 billion, a huge chunk of which would be channeled through the exempt war account. The Senate's plan, however, would allow for the option to reach the president's full defense request by adjusting those spending caps. The president's budget proposal relied upon rosy economic projections predicting years of robust growth with no downturn in sight. The annual economic report of the president predicts 3.2% growth this year and growth averaging 3% through 2024. It's a stark contrast to the Congressional Budget Office's forecast of 2.3% this year and about 1.7% through 2023. The White House gets to its figures through a variety of caveats, assuming that all of its policies would be enacted, including more tax cuts, more deregulation of the labor market, and passage of a $1 trillion infrastructure spending plan this year. Thus, the administration's projections are not only rosy, achieving them would also require an incredible amount of bipartisan cooperation, since Democrats want to rewrite the 2017 tax code overhaul, and there's no agreement in sight on financing infrastructure investment. Up next, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Policy Director Josh Gordon will join me to discuss healthcare and the idea of Medicare for All. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and Policy Director, Josh Gordon. Josh directs Concord's research on the federal budget, healthcare policy, and tax policy. He has a PhD from the University of Florida, and he's been on the show several times to share his expertise. And of course, Bob is a regular contributor. Welcome to Facing the Future once again, Bob and Josh.
Hi, good to be with you.
Yes, indeed.
Well, the reason why I wanted to have you on the show today is to talk about a pretty broad topic, and that is healthcare. It's one that's being discussed on the campaign trail here in New Hampshire. It's an important topic as it pertains to the federal budget. I want to get to the issue of Medicare for All specifically down the road here. Before we get there, Bob, maybe you can share a little bit of insight for our listeners on the state of healthcare spending within the federal budget. And then, Josh, maybe we can pivot to you and you can share with us what's going on with the healthcare market in general and cost growth and things of that nature.
Just to set the stage on the federal budget, there's probably no bigger challenge for the federal budget than healthcare costs, primarily through Medicare and Medicaid, also the smaller SCHIP program, which is a shared program with the states. And, of course, the Affordable Care Act subsidies, otherwise known as Obamacare. So you wrap all of the federal health care programs together and factor in that they're tend to grow faster than the economy, which means that they're a growing share of the federal budget, and the fact that they're increased beneficiaries because you have aging baby boomers like me that are qualifying for Medicare and Medicaid, which partially covers long-term care services. This is really the driving force on the spending side of our long-term fiscal challenge. And Social Security is sometimes lumped in with that, too. But when you look at it, it is Medicare and the other health care programs grow even faster than Social Security, because Social Security is basically just a matter of increased beneficiaries. And with Medicare and the other health care programs, you have not just increased beneficiaries, but the programs growing faster than the economy. So, you know, we sometimes look at sources of growth in the federal budget over the next 10 years or even the next longer term, 25 or 30 years. And all of the spending is accounted for by the healthcare programs. All of the increase is accounted for by the healthcare programs and Social Security. Measured as a share of the economy, other programs are actually projected to shrink. There are caps on discretionary spending. There's no reason why those programs, including defense, grow faster than the economy. So that's why we really need to look at – that's why healthcare is a federal budget issue. It's obviously important for many other reasons, too, but it's a very important program when looking at the sustainability of the federal budget.
So, Josh, getting that broader picture in terms of healthcare spending in the federal budget – what's going on in the healthcare market right now? Bob mentioned demographics can be driving this cost growth. Are there other factors as we're seeing cost growth rise, especially in comparison to other nations?
Yeah, I mean, that cost growth is really the big issue for the United States and healthcare overall. So the growth in the cost of the federal budget healthcare programs, as Bob said, is partly demographic, but the big challenge is that we have healthcare costs grow faster than the economy, and that happens both in our public programs and also in the private healthcare market. So that really is the defining feature when we talk about healthcare and problems with healthcare. That kind of underlies all of the conversation over insurance costs, how to pay for it, what's happening when you go to the hospital and get bills. All of these things are wrapped up in the fact that we have healthcare costs that grow faster than the economy. And on the largest level, what that really means is that the healthcare sector in the United States is projected to grow from 1/6 of the entire economy to 1/5 of the entire economy just over the next 10 years. and then, of course, projected to keep increasing beyond that. And getting a handle on that problem is the trickiest federal budgetary problem to solve. And as an addendum onto that, I would say that the reason for that inflation is very varied. Part of it is that we are getting new things and new technology. That tends to be expensive in the healthcare market. And so that means we're finding things that can make us healthier, and they just happen to be expensive. And then you asked about other countries. There's also the problem that in the United States, we are uniquely inefficient in our ability to translate our healthcare spending into better healthcare outcomes. And that inefficiency is also a defining feature of our healthcare market. Your average developed country spends about half of what we do on a per capita basis, and their healthcare outcomes are the same or better than ours. And that basic problem is why you hear a lot of talk about having really major changes to healthcare in the United States.
So, Josh, I had a piggyback off of that. Just the word efficiency or inefficiency really stood out to me there. Are other nations able to have better efficiencies than the U.S. because they have stronger price controls or regulations, or is it truly a delivery issue?
It's everything. And that's why it's such a tricky issue. Basically, all of the incentives in our healthcare system move towards increasing costs. And the way that other countries manage that is different. They do it in different ways. So I think when we look at what reforms the United States has to think about, it really involves kind of all of the levers, from patients being more cost conscious to doctors being more cost conscious to doctors being paid less or paid less based on what they do in terms of how invasive or how often they do things. Insurance companies have very little incentive to reduce costs. Businesses have very little incentive to reduce healthcare costs. So a lot of things have developed in the United States healthcare system that leads to it being uniquely inefficient. And when I say inefficient, it really is, are we getting what we pay for? You can imagine having healthcare costs go up, but having healthcare outcomes go up with that, in which case, as a society, you decide whether you want to put more money towards being healthier. Or you can imagine us saving a lot of money and spending less on healthcare and having the same outcomes as we do now. But right now, we have kind of the worst of all worlds, where we're spending a lot more and not getting what we pay for.
So one political argument that I've heard in this healthcare discussion is that, and talking about this efficiency issue, is that Medicare is actually more efficient than the private sector. Is that actually true? And then rolling this into the Medicare for All discussion, is that why Medicare for All is such an attractive policy proposal for candidates right now?
So there are two different types of efficiency. When I talk about efficiency, I mean, are we getting what we pay for? But then there's the other kind of more specific kind of efficiency where you talk about administrative costs and kind of friction on a business level. And in that sense, Medicare does seem to be more efficient than the private insurance market. And that, I mean, that's pretty intuitive. You don't have a profit motive. You have an easier payment system in terms of less paperwork, mainly because Medicare is so large, so it has scale to have those kinds of administrative efficiencies. But I think when we talk about overall savings and cost control, it really is more than just administrative efficiency. It's the broader efficiency. Are we getting what we pay for?
So, Bob, I'll bring you back into this conversation here. When we're talking about reform in the healthcare system, what do you think is missing from the national conversation at this point?
Well, I think it's a broader conversation about healthcare cost and what's driving it, the sort of things that Josh was talking about. We tend to have political debates about everything, and, you know, Let's go back to 2009 and look at Obamacare, so to speak. I mean, just that very name, Obamacare. Or you could go back further when there was Hillary Care that was attacked. And, you know, I think that everybody acknowledges, both Democrats and Republicans, that growing health care costs is a problem, and the public is, you know, always very sensitive to growing health care costs. And we haven't really focused on how to keep health care costs from growing at such a expanded rate that we have in this country relative to other countries, and getting, you know, not as positive results as Josh was mentioning. So sometimes we get into discussions about, I mean, when people talk about controlling health care costs, a lot of times it focuses on very specific things like the federal government will simply reimburse less or cover less, or, you know, things that could be described, quote unquote, as cuts. Or on the other side, you know, raising premiums to keep up with raising costs for things like Medicare Part B or prescription drugs. So I think that we just tend to have politically motivated discussions about who sponsored what. If President Obama sponsored something, the Republicans are against it. If the Republicans sponsor something, then the Democrats are against it. And I would like to see candidates talk about what are the realistic options for controlling health care costs, regardless of who pays for it. It's not a question of whether the government, quote unquote, should pay for everything, or we should, quote unquote, privatize Medicare, you know, have an entirely private system. Whoever is paying for it, it's what are we paying for? That's the real question.
So I guess a question I have, with all that being said, you mentioned candidates, Bob. It almost seems like candidates right now in the 2020 cycle, and it could be because it's very Democratic heavy, and thus there's a certain approach to healthcare that's being discussed. But I feel like a few steps were skipped, almost like we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater in this healthcare discussion. We skipped right over tweaking and reforming the ACA to that broader Medicare for All discussion. Why do you think there's been such a rapid move in that direction in the political conversation?
I'll give you a somewhat cynical answer, and then Josh can give you a more substantive answer. The cynical answer is that people like free stuff, and particularly the idea of free health care. So my concern about the Medicare for All discussion is that a lot of people and politicians have thrown up their hands at the intense debates over the ACA and just said, let's just cover everybody and have the government pay for it. And, you know, that can be attractive. And it gets into this thing that maybe we can talk about a little bit more later, but of, you know, when people talk about Medicare for All, what do they mean by Medicare for All? People mean different things. It's kind of a Rorschach test, what you think of when you say the term Medicare for All. But I think it's the bottom, what drives it, its popularity, is the idea that everybody would be covered and nobody has to pay for it.
Yeah, and I mean, the kind of the slightly and only slightly more nuanced take on that is that fighting over how you get health insurance, who is going to pay for your health care, is terrain that at least the Democrats feel very comfortable arguing on, because again, you're in a safer space, as Bob said, because you're talking about benefits that people get. And I do understand why you have the argument about who is going to pay for your health care before you have an argument about what are you paying for, because everyone on an individual level, your first concern is making sure your family has health insurance. And that is a safety net, both economically and health-wise. So that tends to come first. But we have spent the last 10 years arguing about that, while we have this kind of continually growing problem of healthcare costs, and we haven't been able to focus very much on that because we've just been arguing about where people are going to get their health insurance from. So as I said, I'm sympathetic to why you argue about that, but at some point, and some point soon, both for the federal budget and for the overall healthcare system, we really need to start talking about trying to get what we're paying for.
Yeah, and just, you know, and it, politically it does make sense in that it's easier to talk about who pays than it is to talk about controlling underlying healthcare costs, because that gets really weedy really fast. And, you know, other countries have more controls over what people can get. It's not exactly rationing, but it's you don't have as many open-ended choices as you do here in our system, and we're not sort of mentally configured as a society to accept limitations. And boy, that's easily attacked on the campaign trail. So it's always politically easier to talk about who pays, and that sort of gets you into this discussion about, well, somebody else should pay.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby and Policy Director Josh Gordon. We've been discussing health care generally and just jumped into the deep pool of Medicare for All. And I want to go back to something you said, Bob, and that was that Medicare for All is almost like a Rorschach test at this point, and it's really up for debate what people mean by Medicare for All. So break it down for me. What do people typically mean by Medicare for All, and how many varieties of it exist?
I think there are two basic varieties. One would be the Bernie Sanders type of Medicare for All, and a similar bill has been introduced in the House. And that really is a universal coverage, expanded benefits, things like long-term care and dental and vision. It's just everything rolled into one. And it is a government-run system, paid-for system. And people would not pay copays or deductibles or premiums or anything like that. The system would be paid for out of general revenues. So the trade-off is that you wouldn't have healthcare expenses, but you would have higher taxes. And that's, you know, one of the difficulties that you got to sort of wade through. But that's not actually Medicare for All, in the sense that if you really literally think about Medicare, Medicare is does have limitations. It does have private insurance plans. In fact, one of the most, you know, fastest growing parts of Medicare is Medicare Advantage, which is the part of Medicare that is really a competitive system between companies that compete for Medicare beneficiaries' business, and people can sign up for whatever plan that they want. And it's a regulated market, of course, but there is private insurance there. Medicare recipients pay premiums, workers pay a dedicated tax. So literally nobody is actually proposing that type of system for all. Now, the other variety is really kind of Medicare for more, as is sometimes referred to, meaning that you lower the eligibility age for people to buy into Medicare or to qualify for Medicare. That's an entirely different thing. That keeps Medicare as it is, but it says people at a younger age can buy in. And I think a lot of candidates are looking at that. Those are really the two main options. It's kind of like universal coverage in the Sanders style, or keeping the Medicare system as it is, but allowing more people to buy into it for their healthcare coverage.
And Josh, I think a question I have for you, we've talked about the issues within the Medicare system and the rapid growth of cost and the fact that revenue is not keeping up with the benefits that are paid out. Would any of those options that Bob just mentioned require also addressing those structural issues within Medicare, or would these proposals fix all those issues?
I know in theory that some of these proposals would try and fix some of those issues. But again, the devil is in the details, and I think this month we kind of had a perfect encapsulation of this, where you had a lot of Democrats on the campaign trail and on the Hill sign on to different forms of Medicare for All the way we're talking. But then at the same time, you had President Trump submit a budget proposal, and I'm sure your listeners have heard and can look up what the Concord Coalition thought about the budget proposal in general. But there were some specifics in that budget proposal that involved making some decent reforms to Medicare to make it more cost conscious, to have costs not grow as quickly, to experiment on ways to keep costs down. And the Trump administration really is building on Obama administration proposals for some of that cost control. And then you have this weird vector of a lot of the same Democrats that are rushing to support Medicare for All talk very negatively about those Trump Medicare proposals. Yet all of their Medicare for All plans depend on Medicare keeping costs down and getting more efficient. And it would require those types of proposals to do so. It's not enough to talk about the details for how people are going to become eligible to get insurance from whatever new Medicare system you're creating. You also need to talk about, once they are on that system, how you're going to control healthcare costs. Because one of the things they claim is that by moving people onto Medicare, we will have lower costs. Well, I want to see how they are going to achieve that. And I don't think they will achieve that in any very different way from what the Trump administration proposed, from what the Obama administration proposed. And actually, we're going to need a lot more of those types of proposals in the future.
Yeah, this is a hugely important point because it goes to the key question of how Medicare for All would be financed. And you have to look at the assumptions behind, say, the universal health care plans. In order to keep down costs, what they assume is that reimbursement rates for doctors and hospitals and other providers would match Medicare's current reimbursement rates. And there are some, you know, Medicare does not reimburse at the same rate, as high a rate as private insurance does. So you're assuming with the Medicare for All type proposal that hospitals and physicians and other providers would take a very large cut in reimbursements from what they're getting now, and that would be matching Medicare, which raises a couple of issues. One is, are those Medicare cuts that are assumed in law at all sustainable? A lot of people think they aren't. They're just, you know, projected into the future, and the Medicare actuaries say, you know, what's in law here, you know, a lot of hospitals might go out of business because they might not be able to achieve the efficiencies that Congress assumed that they would be able to when they wrote these reimbursement laws. And now that whole system, which might be unsustainable, would be applied to the entire healthcare system and not just to Medicare. So if you're assuming that that's one way that the system would be financially sustainable, it might rest on shaky grounds as to whether or not the healthcare system would be able to handle it.
A question I have, and Josh, you sort of alluded to, you want to see some more numbers and what some of those cost controls would be and how they'd have an impact. Have there been any other organizations or agencies like CBO that have come out with any kind of analysis of alternative scenarios, almost like what CBO does with the budget outlook, on how these plans might have a fiscal impact and what it would look like? And if they have they compared it to a net effect of what people pay now for healthcare and what the healthcare system costs now relative to what it might be under one of these Medicare for All or universal healthcare systems?
So there are two ways to answer that. The first is that, yes, other organizations have looked into the costs of some of these proposals and the transitions and the overall increase in spending and kind of the gaps between that increase in spending and whatever revenues are at least currently dedicated to Medicare and the government overall. But we don't have enough details of any of these proposals to really figure it out. And I think we also should be talking at a more basic level. If we are talking about going to a Medicare for All in the Bernie Sanders way, we really need to have a bigger discussion over letting people know how much of healthcare is currently financed by employers, how much is financed by employees, and then you also have the Medicare financing, which we've talked about as being unsustainable. And I really think we haven't gotten enough of that discussion to really start talking about numbers. So, there are smaller proposals that have been scored by CBO, Medicare eligibility age changes at a very small level. But really, I think it's more important at this point on the campaign trail to just be straight with the American people about what the direction of this is going to take, that we are not necessarily going to all be saving a lot of money simply by eliminating all private insurance and putting everyone on Medicare for all. Certainly over the first 10 years, we have really no idea what the score would be. And honestly, a 10-year score for something like this would be very unimportant relative to where things would be over the longer term with a full transition. So, you see some very large numbers thrown out about costs, but I don't know. I think right now, because we don't have a lot of details and because people on the campaign trail don't really want to get into weeds like that, it's more important to just be upfront and honest about what our system looks like now, what you really think we should be moving towards, and then talking about that transition. We're a long way off from transforming into a full Bernie Sanders-style single-payer system, and I think it almost distracts by talking about large numbers, because we do need to change our healthcare system, and some of that change is going to be dramatic, no matter what, because as right now we have kind of this do-nothing plan where we just don't want to talk about what we have to do as a society to get lower healthcare costs. And we need to really understand that our current system is unsustainable. There have to be changes. So let's talk about that and talking about cost control and then figure out how these things interact going forward. But Bob might have other thoughts.
Well, I'm a little bit more sympathetic to the numbers simply because if you're talking about a policy, eventually it does have to be scored. And so it's important to talk about the magnitude of these things. As a matter of fact, President Obama recently was talking to the House Democrats freshman class at one of the points that he was making is it's okay to think big. You should think big. But you do need to think about the cost of things because people do care about that issue. And so now I am also sympathetic with Josh's point that numbers sometimes get tossed around as weapons rather than as estimates. If you want to scare somebody about how expensive something it is. And so the vaguer a proposal, the more, susceptible it is to having some horribly scary number put on it. And these things, the devil is in the details, and some of them are quite big. And just to give you a range of the numbers, I mean, I think the Sanders plan during the last campaign in 2016, he was talking about a net cost of, let's just say, $11 trillion or something like that. And then others looked at it and thought it would be like in the at least twice as much, as much as $30 trillion. And so you get estimates like that for a Medicare for all plan, and it's hard to evaluate them. The trade-off would be that, as I said before, people wouldn't, they'd be paying in a different way. So even if you theorize that people would be saving money by not having healthcare expenses, that same cost would be transferred somehow into the tax system, so people would have higher taxes. And politically, that's an issue because you understand what you're paying for through the healthcare system because, even if you don't like it, if you think it's too high, it's going for healthcare, whereas if you get a bill from the federal government, You're happy that you're not paying anything for healthcare, but taxes are very transparent. You have to pay them. So that's another issue politicians need to deal with. But so I a little bit more sympathetic about these estimates, because you do need to give people a general sense whether something is an incremental approach like a Medicare buy-in or a Sanders-type universal healthcare system, which would be hugely more expensive. So some magnitude is important there when people are thinking about the trade-offs and whether they think it's good policy.
And I would just add one more thing that just to show that I am not completely wanting to ignore the numbers. I think what advocates really should grapple with is there have been three different states that have tried to do state-based single-payer systems, partly due to the flexibility from the Affordable Care Act. And the states that tried to do this, some tried to do Medicaid for all, some tried to do, a state-based single-payer system. In all three cases, the effort fell apart because of financing issues. So even in the most motivated states that had money from the federal government to make this transition and an Obama administration that was willing to help them in terms of changing rules for Medicaid funding, the states all failed because they couldn't get the financing right. And if I was an advocate for single payer, I would really want to look into what happened there and start being honest about how big of a challenge that really is.
And Josh, you just hit on a good point there. And we're in the middle of a presidential election. I'm in New Hampshire. We talk to voters all the time. How would you encourage the average voter, the individual going to campaign events right now and talking to the candidates, how would you encourage them to engage in this conversation?
Yeah, if I was going to confront a candidate about these issues, I would just ask the candidate to be open and honest about what happens in the transition and what the system ultimately looks like. And the candidate should promise to put more meat on the bones. If the candidate is not ready to do it at the town hall meeting, maybe ask the candidate when they plan to have specifics so that voters can better evaluate their thinking on these issues. I think a lot of times candidates say they sign on to Plan X, and then that is the end of discussion, move on to something else. Even if a candidate is signing on to a Plan X that they maybe didn't necessarily come up with from scratch, they should be held just as accountable to the details on that Plan X as if they had come up with it by scratch. And after the election is not a good answer to that question. The details should be before the election.
Yeah, and I just think that it's that old question about how would you pay for it, and maybe probing a little bit on, you know, what obstacles need to be overcome in order to make your vision of the healthcare system come true. And that would be a way of confronting some of these trade-offs.
And let me just put in a plug from the, you know, the deficit hawk in all of us here at the Concord Coalition, that when we ask for a description of how they're going to pay for it, we're not just talking about taxes or premiums. We're talking about the debt, and within the context of the debt going up to unsustainable levels in the future. We're concerned about it because having an increase in debt increases the chance that we'll have slower economic growth for this generation and for future generations. There is no reason why moving to a different healthcare system should hurt our economic growth. We should be doing it because we need to reform the healthcare system because it is inefficient, and reforming the healthcare system and getting our debt under control will help increase economic growth in the future. And even the economists that are kind of reevaluating their opinion on how scary debt is universally agree that healthcare is one of those things that we should be paying for. It is not one of those things we should be paying for by debt. You might be able to convince a lot of economists that borrowing money to invest in the future makes sense for things like infrastructure or new energy technologies. But I have not yet seen a credible economist argue that we should be borrowing to fund healthcare consumption, especially the inefficient healthcare consumption we have in the United States.
And Chase, I'm going to end on, it's a very big issue for all of the candidates that are coming through New Hampshire and the candidate sitting at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Bob Bixby, as well as Policy Director Josh Gordon. We've been discussing health care and Medicare for All. Thank you both for joining the show once again.
You're welcome.
We'll be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So, it's time to face this fact. Over-optimistic economic projections could lead Washington astray. Although the tax and spending suggestions in President Trump's new budget have received most of the attention, the unrealistic nature of his projections on economic growth must be kept in mind as Congress begins working on plans for fiscal year 2020. As the Concord Coalition pointed out when the White House released its budget, the plan is based on economic growth assumptions that are considerably higher than most other forecasts, with the administration projecting inflation-adjusted GDP growth at 3% or above through 2024. Such high growth projections enable the administration to assume large gains in federal revenue and less demand for federal assistance programs. This would mean smaller deficits over the next decade than would otherwise be the case. However, if other forecasts are more on target, it means that the large deficits that the Trump administration is already projecting for the coming years will be even larger than advertised. Of particular interest are the recent economic growth projections by the Congressional Budget Office, which serves as Washington's official nonpartisan scorekeeper on fiscal policies and proposals. It presents a far less encouraging picture than the administration does. CBO projects that growth will slow from 3.1% in 2018 to 2.3% in the current year, and down to 1.7% in 2020 through 2023. While some of this projected slowdown is based on the diminishing effects of the 2017 tax cut legislation, the primary factors are the aging population, leading to slower labor force growth and lagging labor productivity. Comparing the economic growth projections by CBO and the White House, Howard Gleckman of the Tax Policy Center sees, quote, a tale of two economies. On average, he notes, the budget office projects that the economy will grow about a full percentage point more slowly over the next decade than the administration anticipates. That difference adds up, Gleckman says. Not to mention, a panel of 55 of the nation's business economists also foresee a sharp slowdown in U.S. economic growth over the next 2 years, as reported in the latest survey by the National Association for Business Economics, or NABE. Its economists collectively project that growth, as measured by GDP, will reach 2.4% this year and just 2% in 2020. Key factors in their assessment include a global slowdown and the ongoing trade conflicts between the Trump administration and several major trading partners. NABE economists did not go so far as to predict a recession, however, saying there's about a 10% likelihood of a recession in the first half of this year, a 20% chance in the second half of this year, and a 35% chance of a recession by the end of 2020. Such projections are also in line with an updated outlook that the Federal Reserve released last week. While economic forecasting is difficult work, the large differences between the administration's projections and most others is cause for concern and deep skepticism about the president's entire budget. Even if a recession is not predicted to be an immediate concern, at some point, there will be one. Many analysts expect it might even come within the next 2 or 3 years, in part because the current period of economic growth is already a lengthy one by historic standards. And whenever the next recession occurs, there will be further upward pressure on federal deficits. The case for the administration's projections might be more credible if some of its current policies were not actually undermining growth. But trade fights have hurt the economy, immigration policies have exacerbated labor shortages, and the 2017 tax legislation has fallen short of its promised benefits. Both the administration and Congress must be realistic in their expectations for economic growth while focusing on measures such as labor force growth, productivity, entitlement reform, infrastructure improvements, more efficient tax policies, and cost-saving improvements in the delivery of healthcare services. In addition, elected officials must shift the federal budget onto a sustainable path. Such measures
can lay the foundations for solid long-term economic growth, and that growth could help the country deal with its fiscal and demographic challenges. You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.